And we move on to the next talk by Roland Cotes, revealing the nature of the unusual pulsar wind nebula CTB87. I see in the meantime that there is now a question mark, so it may not be that unusual, I guess. We can also have meta unusual, which means it's unusual that it is not unusual.
Is that better?
Okay. Unusualness.
Good, thank you. Okay, thank you very much. So I want to talk today about pulsar wind nebula I've been working on for probably since my PhD thesis, actually. So you can imagine it's quite a while ago. And two of my collaborators are still my supervisors from that time. That's Wolfgang Reich and Ernst Fürst. And I also work together with Samar and with Benson, who are both here in the audience. So CTB87, I should probably introduce you to this source a little bit at the beginning. So it's known for a long time. It's a bright radio source. It's a pulsar wind nebula. These are Westerbork observations, starting here at 3 centimeter, going to, I think, 92 centimeter here. You can see it's highly polarized. It has this typical kidney-shaped structure you can see here and here and here. When you go to the lower frequencies, I mean, this is an interferometer. Of course, you cut out large scales, but you can still see some diffuse emission around here. Please keep that in mind, because it may be that will become important later. In X-ray, we did a study a few years ago with the Chandra satellite. CTB87 was actually not visible in Einstein observations, and you couldn't see it in ROSAT either. The first observation in X-ray that you can actually see the source is from ASCA. And in Chandra, you can see here, of course, there's a compact source here from which we did not see any pulsations. But the compact source, and you have these jet features and the torus around here, the typical for a neutron star or for a pulsar. And here, with the radio contours overlaid, you can see there's some diffuse X-ray emission which covers most of the kidney-shaped feature here. There's a compact source here. It's a little bit of emission also here. And when you look at it, it's at the outer edge of the radio remnant. So it kind of gives the impression that it moved here somewhere from this direction here. To have a look at the distance and the environment, the distance has been determined many, many times before with H1 absorption measurements. I really like to show this spectrum here because it's a typical spectrum as you want it. You have a supernova remnant or pulsar wind nebula, which is absorbed, and then nearby an extragalactic source. And all the components are exactly the same, except for the last one, which is missing in the pulsar wind nebula. So you can say, okay, the source must be somewhere in between here. And it also shows some emission structures in H1 and in CO at about 60, 65, minus 60, minus 65 kilometers per second. So there's a study by Liu et al. From 2018, who put all the environment observations together into a combined picture. And it seems to be sitting in a big cavity here in H1 and in dust. There's some H1 around it. It's not really clear if it is just a hole or in a stellar wind bubble, but there are a lot of stars in here who probably contributed to emptying the space. And CTB87 is somewhere close to the edge here. And there's molecular stuff. You cannot see it here very well. There's some molecular stuff out here with which it might be interacting. So these are the old observations that we newly analyzed now of CTB87. So that looks very, very much similar to the Westerbork observation from before. The difference is you can see this diffuse component outside a little bit better. I left this extragalactic source in here so that you can see what it looks like. And here I removed it. But I mean, this area is, of course, a bit contaminated, so it's a bit difficult to interpret. So it's 408 megahertz, 1420 megahertz from the Collating Galactic Plane Survey, 6 centimeter Effelsberg. These are all Effelsberg measurements here, 2.8 centimeter, 2 centimeter, and 9 millimeters. It's a little, it took a lot of observing time here, but it's still a bit rough. So yeah, you can see the kidney shape feature, and you can see this extended emission now very well, and at least on these four observations. This was just measured too small. And it seems to have a flatter spectrum, so you cannot really see it in a low frequency observations anymore. The integrated spectrum, you have seen this before when you have looked at CTB87. It has a relatively flat spectrum, typical of a pulsar wind nebula here up to about 10 gigahertz, then it steepens. That's actually at least what people believe. What I found always a bit weird is here these typical frequencies we observe SNRs here at 6 centimeter and at 21 centimeter. there's a wide spread of fluxes. I mean, here at 6 centimeters, you have the lowest flux of 4 Janskis and the highest flux of almost 9 Janskis. That's ridiculous for a Jansky kind of source. It's not a 100 millijansky source or so. A factor of 2 for a Jansky kind of source with such a fluctuation is ridiculous. So there must be something wrong in here, something that people determine the fluxes differently, or there's a difference between interferometer and single dish observations. And the same thing here. I mean, we have here the filled ones are the new measurements here. They seem to be getting a break in here. These are AMI measurements from England. Yeah, so there's something very peculiar about this. So what we did was we wanted to check the spectral indices here and here. There's a method called T-plots. So we plotted here at 2 frequencies, fluxes of the source, once here and once here, and we fitted it once the first frequency as a function of the second and the other, and vice versa. And from the gradient, you get a spectral index. And the top row T-plots are all frequencies before the break, so at lower frequencies, and at the bottom, above the break, at higher frequencies. So here it should be minus 0.3, and here it should be minus 1.1, and it actually is very, very constant. I mean, within the arrow bars at least, it's relatively constant even over the break. So this kidney-shaped feature, which is the brightest stuff here, which would be favored by the TT-plots, seem to have a constant spectrum without a break. So we separated, or we tried to separate it from the background, and we saw that it kind of has 2 components. These are the only frequencies where we had enough map size and also resolution to do this properly. So here's a typical kidney-shaped feature that you saw in the interferometric measurements, and there's a smooth component around here. And this is a single-dish measurement, and it's interferometer with single-dish added into it for the short spacings. And even though it looks a little bit different here, there seems to be a real component. In particular here, you can see it very well. So there are 2 components to this source. And when you now do the T-plots on both components, here on the left, it's the kidney-shaped feature. It's exactly the spectral index we saw as a combined source. And here this diffuse component seems to have a flatter spectrum, very similar to the spectrum before the break. So in flux, this seemed to dominate the entire source. And here's the spectrum of the kidney-shaped compact feature. So it's pretty straight now. It's exactly the same spectral index we got from the TT-plots, and I added even in here VLSS from VLA observations here, 74 megahertz, and it looks very straight, minus 0.4, which is steep for a pulsar wind nebula, of course. We also don't see a break in here in the spectrum, so that means the break cannot be an intrinsic break produced by the pulsar, by the particle acceleration. So the only possibility left would be that the diffuse component is also pulsar wind nebula, and the break is a cooling break. But for that, you need a ridiculously high magnetic field, which contain about 10 to the 52 ergs of energy, so that's not possible. So the break was probably only produced by the high frequency measurements, just the maps being too small and the background being put onto that diffuse component, so that the break looked like it was there, but it's actually not real. Let's have a look at the polarization measurements. I have only 4 frequencies in polarization. That's either 21 centimeter, 6 centimeter, it's a lower resolution, 2.8 centimeter and 9 millimeter. And most of the emission here seem to be, also here, seem to be the compact feature, so the kidney-shaped feature. But you see, you get some patches, diffuse emission around here, disregard this here, that's a compact source. But so the diffuse component seems to be polarized as well. A rotation measure, so it's pretty high rotation measure, minus 100 here in the top part, and this little blob here seems to have a positive rotation measure, which is a bit unusual. The foreground rotation measure in this direction should be highly positive, at least that's what the nearby pulsars tell us. So this must be internal to the pulsar, and it also is indicated by the percentage polarization, which goes down with wavelengths, so there must be some internal effects that reduce the polarization. So this rotation measure must be internal, which also indicates that it is a relic pulsar wind nebula, as we got from the X-ray measurements, because a relic pulsar wind nebula is a pulsar wind nebula that had a reverse shock, pushed in a way mixed the ejector into the pulsar wind nebula, so that you have a pulsar wind nebula that's producing the emission and the ejector doing the Faraday rotation. Okay, let's try to put all the information a bit together into a coherent picture. So we have an SNR that is expanding inside a large cavity, off-centered, located, and near a molecular cloud. So you have here the position of the neutron star or the putative neutron star. These are the peaks of the radio emission, and you're kind of, it looks a little bit like these are aligned. So, of course, if we assume that this diffuse component, which is polarized, which is centered here, which really looks like a picture book example as of a pulsar wind nebula, if it is actually the pulsar wind nebula left over from the neutron star in that cavity, and this kidney-shaped feature is a pulsar wind nebula, or can I just put it in, as the relic pulsar wind nebula, which was created by the reverse shock interacting with that molecular cloud, which should be down here somewhere, then we can imagine that the neutron star took this path to get here, and this marks then the location of the supernova explosion, and this marks the location where the reverse shock hit the pulsar when the pulsar was here. So that's what we assume. Let's have a look at the diffuse component. So the diffuse component has a radius of about 15 parsec. It's expanding inside that cavity, which has a density typically of 0.02 particles per cubic centimeter. We got here the energy loss rate from the X-ray luminosity to be about 10 to the 37 ergs per second. This is empirical relationship, and putting in the usual equations here, the pulsar wind nebula expansion from Chevalier and blast wave and reverse shock, kinematics from Mati and Chulov, then we can calculate the time and the radius at which the reverse shock would hit the pulsar wind nebula with different characteristics for the explosion. So here, these red lines mark the location where the reverse shock hits the pulsar wind nebula for the different masses. And here, the green lines, this is 10 to the 51 ergs, 10 to the 50 ergs, and here a little bit, 10 to the 49 ergs. We can see that the explosion energy, explosion mass must have been somewhere 10 solar masses or higher. So we can conclude it should be a type 2 explosion, which is not very surprising in this case. The energy we cannot really constrain very well from here. It should not be very, very high, and it should not be very, very low, but somewhere in the mid 10 to the 50 range. Okay, let's have a look at the relics. So let's assume this is the diffuse nebula, pulsar wind nebula, and the shock wave expanded here to the molecular clouds. We don't really know where they are. You can see the molecular emission around here, but of course they could be displaced along the line of sight. So 5 kiloparsec, which is a distance between here and here, is a lower radius or lower distance of the molecular cloud, and you just calculate what happens if the blast wave goes here into the molecular cloud, is slowed down, produce a reverse shock, which goes back, and then you calculate the time when it would hit the pulsar here. So I used the constraints from the previous diffuse emission and tried to play around with the parameters. The density of the CO cloud is about 80 per cubic centimeter. So what we get there is with these parameters here, the time to collide with the pulsar for the reverse shock is 11,000 years. The energy is about 2 to 3 times 10 to the 50 erg. The age, 30,000 years, velocity of the pulsar, 100 kilometers per second. That would be the radius of the blast wave inside the stellar wind bubble or the cavity. For these parameters are pretty constant, independent of the explosion mass or the ejector mass. And even the radius inside the cloud, that's the radius between or the distance between the blast wave in the cloud and the location of the explosion, is about 11 parsec. And I promised in my abstract that I will show you the shell of CTB87. Of course, this one is nothing I can show to you. And people have looked there for ages. Hundreds of people had deep observation at a distance of whatever 20 arc minutes from the pulsar wind nebula. They didn't find anything. So what I concentrate on is this here, and I will show you now the shell. And you will see it's actually quite obvious. It's down here. Yeah, so this is a polarized intensity image at 6 centimeter. I just blew it up a little bit so that you can see the fainter features. And these circles here marks the 10.5, 11, and 11.5 parsec radius from the explosion point. And here you have a shell. We can only see the shell in polarized intensity, but the magnetic field is somehow aligned to this, at least in this part here, when you correct for Faraday rotation. We can now play around with the parameters a little bit, make it more realistic. I started now with that the pulsar started with 10 to the 39 ergs per second, and then developed normally the rotation energy losses. And then we get a bit better ages, so the collision time with the pulsar and the reverse shock is 5,500 years. explosion energy of 10 to the 51 erg, and the age is now 15,000 years. And yeah, these things actually didn't really change. If I increase this a little bit, then the radius goes a bit further, but not really very much. Yeah, also, I put here that's the contours of the diffuse component at 2.8 centimeter, and you can see it at the outskirts. But in total power, you don't see any enhancement of the emission. But when you look at it, the percentage polarization here is about 20 to 30%. Here the contours of the kidney-shaped feature relative to the shell here. Okay, that's it. I just put here the summary and conclusions here, and thank you very much.
We're all very well in time. Questions? Yoshi?
Thank you. So can you go over a bit the evidence for the diffuse radio emission?
Okay, so the diffuse, it doesn't go back anymore. Anyway, so the diffuse component, it looks like a pulse of a nebula. So with a peak in the center, it is very diffuse, it is spherical, the edge is not well defined, and it's linearly polarized. Now, so that's and the location of the center fits exactly to where we would think that the pulsar came from.
So I guess my question is, why is it necessarily distinct from the relic pulsar wind nebula as opposed to one source that has higher surface density region and then a lower
It shouldn't be. I mean, there's of course a continuation between them. They should contact. Only our separation of different spatial components made them look distinct.
Okay.
I mean, the kidney-shaped feature, of course, had the reverse shock interacting with the pulsar wind, and that could, of course, change the spectrum. Could also enhance magnetic fields, compress magnetic fields. In the kidney-shaped feature, the magnetic field is following that curvature of the kidney shape, and exactly parallel to it, the reverse shock must have come back. So if it hits magnetic fields like that, it would compress it. Yeah, so the reason why this is brighter is probably because magnetic field was compressed and maybe even electrons accelerated or particles accelerated. I'm not really that familiar with what can happen with a reverse shock. Certainly the reverse shock could not have been as powerful as we saw yesterday in Thea's talk, where it was globally coming back to the whole remnant. Here it's just a little bit, but the energy of the reverse shock must be comparable to what the pulsar wind nebula has, so that they actually interact and not destroy each other.
Thank you. Other questions? Yes, Steve.
So now that you've corrected the kidney shaped feature, okay, so that the break has gone away for the kidney shaped feature. So where does the X-ray emission lie on compared to the extrapolation of the radio?
I don't know that now. The X-ray, as I remember. Drawing a long time ago, drawing a spectrum that was going there, going down, and when you extrapolated, an X-ray was above what you would have extrapolated from there.
Was that with the old steep break?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's possible that it's more rational now.
Yeah. I mean, the X-ray emission, of course, should be coming from electrons, which are probably pretty young because it is still pretty close to the pulsar. So the diffuse component would not show any X-ray emission, just that the kidney-shaped fail.
Any more questions? If not, let's thank Roland again.